In this episode of Fictional Hangover, we talk about teeth, wishes, hope, beauty, magic, and whimsy in our discussion of Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor, narrated by Christine Bam. Everybody, welcome to Fictional Hangover, a podcast about young adult and new adult books, series, authors, and voice actors that is full of spoilers. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire, and today we're going to discuss Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor, narrated by Christine Bam.
Standard disclaimer, if you haven't read this book, please remember that Fictional Hangover is all about spoilers. If you haven't read or listened and don't want to be spoiled, stop listening to us and go read or listen to the book. Then come back. If you haven't done this but want to pretend that you have, or if you don't care about spoilers, or if you just like the show so much that you don't care about any of that, then listen up. Seriously, everyone needs to go and read this book because I love it so much. And I'm not just saying that because it's one of my favorite books.
I mean, you are partially.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
You're not going to tell somebody to go and read some rubbish. Well, actually, that's a lie. I've told many, many people to read a certain pterodactyl-based literature.
Yeah, and I've told lots of people to read Model Land by Tyra Banks. So
I want to read that so much because in comparison to some of the stuff we read this year, two things I can think of particularly, that is going to be a work of genius.
There's lots of smizing in it, so you should be excited about that.
I can smize. I've seen America's Top Model. I smize. Yeah,
everyone should be professional smizers now because of having to wear masks. You have to smize, otherwise people don't know that you're a jolly individual. Smizing.
I kind of want a mask that's just my hands.
Yeah. I kind of want a mask that's my mouth.
Yeah. You could just get a plastic one, though, and actually it be your mouth. And then people who need to lip read can lip read.
I don't talk to people. People don't need to see what I have to say.
I know. It's like the only time I ever go out is to the supermarket, and then I use the BP self-serve checkout, so I don't actually need to interact with anything but a robot.
Yeah. Yeah, no one needs to talk to me. No one needs to see my mouth.
Just a sassy eyebrow.
Yes.
Have you ever painted your eyebrows on just to have one that looks like, you know, sassy brow? Then you don't even have to use the muscles in order to...
No, but I kind of want to because I can't make the other eyebrow go up on its own. And now here's 20 seconds of me trying to do my eyebrows. Here you go, Constance. All for you. Anyway, do you know that there's a character in this book who has expressive eyebrows?
Is there? Tell me more. Or shall we read the summary?
Well, we could read the summary, but we have to get through a couple of other things first.
That is true. That is true.
Background info.
You must have pleasurably read so much.
I've read a million things by and about Lainey Taylor, but the background info I chose to share this time is found in the back of the 10th anniversary edition of this book, which just came out, and they have new, beautiful covers. It's very lovely.
Everything I like the about neon this cover new edition of is one lovely. It's really good. The neon's nice.
Yeah. So, in the back of that 10th anniversary edition, Lainey Taylor talks about notebooks she uses when she starts a new book. And the one for this one was called Wishbone. And there are some really interesting things that she shares about it. But my favorite is this. A note in green ink that suggests, what if in book two, Kaz is no longer a fake vampire, but a real one? Huh? I enjoyed that a lot. That doesn't happen. Spoiler alert for book two, Kaz is not a vampire. Yeah. Yep. All I want to do is read those notebooks. That's it. That's all I ever want to do is read them all. There are a couple of pictures of them, of some of her pages But mm-hmm. I was reading that as an ebook, not as an actual book, because I have a first edition publication of it. So I didn't really get to look very closely at those, but I want to.
I am surprised you do not possess them, in that you have gone to Lady Taylor's house in the dead of night, snuck in, and abducted them.
Well, I don't want to do that.
No, I mean, your love of Lady Taylor is very well known. Very well known.
Yeah, but not, I don't love her so much that I want to break into her house. Because okay. That's creepy love. And I don't have creepy love. I have regular admiration love.
Regular safe love. Good.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. But anyway, I'm so happy that we're covering at least this first one. Because I live for the magic and whimsy in this book. Like, so much. And it also helped me get a job.
Really?
This book, yeah. Yep. Yeah, back many, 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 many years ago, before I moved out of Arkansas the first time, when I was applying for the job that I eventually got in Florida and then moved to Florida for, they asked me to share a book. And so when I shared this book, I said, hold on, I'm going to need just a second. And they were like, okay. And I moved away from camera because, you know, we were doing like a Skype chat. I moved away from the camera and I came back with a blue wig on and I gave the book talk as Karoo and they were like, yeah, done. It was great.
Nice.
I really enjoyed it.
Nice.
And then the manager, you know, after I left that position, we were able to become friendlier, as not like as friends, not as manager and employee. And when I went to the BAM, the Books and Music Festival in West Palm Beach last year, where I actually got to meet Lainey Taylor and take her out to dinner, that manager still works at that library. And she was like, oh, I'm just so excited that you get to meet Lainey Taylor, because do you remember that time that you had blue hair and then we hired you? Like, yes, I do. Thank you very much. So that was fun. That was a lot of fun. Also, got to meet Lainey Taylor and take her out to dinner. Yeah, uh-huh. One of the best evenings of my life.
Nice.
Yeah, anyway, I love Lainey Taylor, and I need to stop talking about how much I love Lainey Taylor, because it's getting to be embarrassing.
Well, you know, I mean, you have the power of editing, so let's not forget that. But we do have the summary to cover. And then, afterwards, you can resume the fangirling.
Okay. Did you have any initial thoughts?
It's been a long, long time since I've read this book. I read it when it first came out. I had a signed first edition UK cover. It was gorgeous. It was purple. It was feathers. It was shiny. I do not possess it anymore. I do not know where it has gone. It may have been donated in one of the mass change, like when we moved house. Things got put into boxes and then lost, and things got put into boxes that were the wrong boxes, and you know, all these things happen, unfortunately, when you move. I think it was in a box because we are missing quite a few other books that we would not get rid of, and I don't know where it is. Lost to time.
Okay. So we're going to start the summary. Karoo, a blue-haired art student in Prague, walks to school and is attacked by a vampire. Gasp! Don't worry, the vampire is really just her ex-boyfriend, Kaz, pestering her to join his new vampire tour group. Ugh, Kaz. It's the worst. Handsomely gorgeous Kaz. Karoo gave him everything, if you know what I mean, and she regrets it. She turns Kaz down and continues on to school, escaping him and greeting her best friend, Zuzana. Zuz is a tiny, beautiful bundle of rage who only scrapes 5 feet tall if she's wearing platform boots. She immediately asks for Karoo's sketchbooks to see what she drew over the weekend. Karu's sketchbooks are bursting with drawings of chimera, creatures made of mixed animal and sometimes human parts. There's a snake woman, Issa, a giraffe man, Twiga, a curly-haired parrot woman, Yasri, and Brimstone, the wishmonger. So many wonderful creatures that defy imagination, but they're real! Just like Karu's hair really is blue, it grows out of her head that way. Brimstone, the star of her sketchbooks, is real too, and when Zuzana asks what he got up to this weekend, and Karu replies that he bought alligator teeth from a murderer, she wasn't lying. He really does deal in wishes and buy strange teeth from strange people. Even though Karu says it's a true story and has tattoos saying just that, no one believes her. And that's probably for the best.
That makes me sad. Do you know why?
Why?
Her friends, who are creative, wonderful people, are like, it's screaming at them in the face, and they're like, no, we don't believe you. And she's like, with her hands.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd be able to believe her. There's a bunch of weird shit in those sketchbooks, man.
You'd believe weird shit. You'd believe weird shit. You'd want it to be true. You really would.
I would. I would make it true in my heart.
Exactly. So Karu's escape from Kaz is short-lived, as he's taken a job as a living model for her art class. That's so awkward. And now he's naked in front of the classroom.
That is lovely.
Have you ever done a 10-second dick pic?
No. No, I've never nakedly doodled people.
Well, you don't nakedly doodle people. You just have to draw a dick in 10 seconds and the person with the most detail wins. You get bored in an office very easily and these things entertain you. Anywho, back in the room. To get back at him for sharing about his conquest of her whilst she wore a cape and only a cape, then finding him with another girl, Svetla, Karu reaches up to her necklace and makes a wish. This necklace is made of scuppies, the smallest denomination of wishes, but scuppies are enough to slightly torture Kaz with itches. First, his elbow, then his nose, and finally, his butt crack. Watching him squirm nakedly in front of the classroom is almost enough to make her feel better about how he treated her, but she also feels shamed. Brimstone will surely be disappointed in her waste of wishes for an inessential penis.
I love Brimstone.
And that is potentially the greatest name for it ever.
Is that going to be your favourite final thought quote? Inessential penis?
I think it is going to be now. Hang on while I copy and paste. Brimstone is like Karu's father. She has no real family. She knows nothing of where she came from, and she had eyes tattooed like hamsters on her palms for as long as she can remember. She has had an interesting life. And now, at their after-school dinner spot, the Poison Kitchen, Karu receives a note from Kishmish, Brimstone's messenger, telling her she is to go on an urgent errand. Leaving Susanna, she goes to meet Brimstone.
Karu is greeted at the doorway to Brimstone's by Issa, who has to open the door from the inside in order to travel to elsewhere. Otherwise, you just end up in a laundromat or another back alley business, and that's not...
I like to think some kind of like shady Chinese laundry kind of underground gambling den.
Oh, probably. Oh, probably in at least one city. There are many doors all over the world that lead to Brimstone's, and that passage always makes Karu a little queasy. But she's arrived and is ready to receive her errand. She gets a scolding from Brimstone first, though. Who knows why this massive, ram-horned, crocodile-eyed, lion-legged, claw-foot chimera raised Karu since she was a baby, but he did. And now she's in trouble for wasting her skeppies and shings, one step above skeppies, on petty things, and for taking 40 minutes to arrive. If only he'd give her some Gavriels, the second highest denomination of wishes, she'd be able to turn invisible and fly to meet him whenever he summons. But no. There's no way she'd pay for them either. That requires teeth. And a lot of them. for teeth are the only currency used to buy wishes. They are also literally all over the place in Brimstone's office. All kinds of teeth from all kinds of creatures being strung into necklaces between gemstones, or in jars, or bowls, or hanging from garlands. So many teeth.
You like teeth.
Apparently I do, because every book I ever suggest is about teeth.
We need to deep dive into that. There's a lot to unpack there, I feel.
I don't know.
Brimstone sends Karu to Paris through the exact same door she entered from Prague. This door opens to many different places and many different countries, and Karu's been to most of them, sometimes for fun, most of the time for teeth. This is a teeth time. She's to retrieve giant elephant tusks from an auction house, and she does. She lugs them all the way across town and back to the door, but finds it momentarily blocked by two rabbis.
Is that the beginning of a joke?
It feels like it. I felt like I was going to have to reveal a punchline and I don't have one. Quick Google. They seem to be examining something. When they leave and Karu can use the door, she sees what the rabbis must have been talking about. A handprint burned into the door. What if Issa doesn't come? What if she's stuck here forever? Luckily, Issa finally arrives and Karu brings in the tusks. Inside, talking to Brimstone, is a burly, bearded American trader, Bane, who earns 2 gavriels for his assorted bear, wolf and or wildcat teeth, and he winks at Karu on his way out. Karu wants to stay with her Chimera family in her little cot she slept in as a child, but just as she's about to ask, there's a knock at the only other door in the shop. Karu has never seen that door opened, and just like every other time someone comes a knocking, Brimstone ushers her out.
Meanwhile, there are stories about people all over the world finding handprints burned into doorways. Eyewitnesses said they saw beautiful men and beautiful women with beautiful burning eyes and beautiful winged shadows leaving the marks. Akiva, Hazael, and Laraz, angels with glamoured wings unseen by human eyes, unless you happen to notice their shadows, are the ones marking them. Akiva keeps blades sheathed on his back as if he's preparing for battle. And he is! As soon as all the doorways are marked, the war will begin. He'd rather burst through the door now and kill everyone on the other side, but no. The magic of the doors won't let him through, so he continues marking them.
Karu spends the next several days running errands for Brimstone, gathering more and more teeth from all corners of the world. She normally only goes out once or twice a week for teeth gathering, but she's been out 4 times already, and she's got homework to do, and a friend she's been bailing on. I mean, come on, girl's got a life. So when Kishma shows up again, she ignores him and goes to Poison Kitchen with Susanna instead, wasting wishes to get their favourite table. She finally relents and goes to meet Brimstone after spending most of the evening with Zeus, talking about the violin-playing boy she has a crush on and butterflies in her tummies. Brimstone is happy to see Karu when she finally shows up because he thought she was done with them and never coming back. Like, how could she do that? The Chimera are her only family. Where's the insecurity there, Brimstone? Come on. Bless, he needs a hug. The errand she must go on now is one to a person she enjoys visiting, Azeel, but does not enjoy retrieving his deliveries. Azeel is a grave robber and provides many of Brimstone's human teeth. He is also one of the people that is brave enough, or foolish enough, to earn a bruxus, the greatest denomination of wishes, by pulling out all of his own teeth.
Yikes.
Thank you, because I'm too grossed out. I needed that.
Blah. Yikes. And you have to do it yourself. You can't get somebody else to pull them for you. So you have to be, like, coherent.
That's not the word I thought you were going to use.
What did you think I was going to say?
I don't know. Just not coherent. That's really tickled me. Oh, dear me. That's good. Okay, so he wished for knowledge, but was cursed to carry an invisible fallen seraphim, Razgut, on his back for the rest of his life. Razgut is deformed and twisted and awful and constantly muttering things. The grave robber is only able to give a handful of teeth this time, and some of them are baby teeth.
No.
Which Brimstone has only accepted once before. Yuck. As Karoo is preparing to go back to Brimstone's shop, Akiva appears. He has just marked his last doorway, the one Karoo needs to get back.
When she sees Akiva, Karoo gets a tingling in her palms and a feeling that he is an enemy. She runs across town toward the door, but Akiva follows. They fight, he with swords and Karoo only with her bare hands. Surprisingly, her bare hands, or more specifically, the Hamsas tattooed there, repel the angel, flinging him back and into a wall. She makes it to the door, but Issa doesn't answer. Just an old woman who resides behind the actual door. Can you imagine that poor old lady, like this frantic blue-haired girl pounding on the door with a handful of baby teeth? No.
And is she in Marrakesh at this point as well?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. Very confusing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, she's pounding and pounding on the door. But only the old woman keeps coming to the door. Issa never shows up. Then, Akiva... I want you to
cosplay the old woman.
No, I've got an excellent cosplay.
I also want you to cosplay Karoo banging on the door as well, but that's beside the point.
Okay, another time. Then, Akiva appears again and asks Karoo, "Who are you?" Yeah, not a good time to ask who someone is. Maybe you should ask that before you slice them up with your swords. I'm just saying.
Fact.
Finally, Issa comes to the door and Karoo manages to make it through before Akiva can follow or kill her. Good timing. Inside the shop, Brimstone is gone. She's never been allowed inside when he is elsewhere. Issa and Yasri help get Karoo patched up from her fight and force her to rest. This is when she notices that the other door inside the shop is open. She's never seen it open before. So, obviously, she has to know what is on the other side. Making a scuppy wish for silence, she creeps through.
You totally would, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Totally. Going through that door. Yeah.
I don't even know if I'd have the forethought to make a wish for silence. I'd be like, what?
Yuck. Yeah, but if you had scuppies and you could just make wishes for whatever shit you want to,
you'd be lucky if I had any left, to be fair.
Luckily, Brimstone will always give you more, because they're so small, they don't even mean anything. Except for itchy butt cracks.
So many itchy butt cracks. So what's behind the door, I hear you ask? Well, there is another world on the other side of the door. A world with two moons and Chimera, and Brimstone, and Twiga, and uh-oh.
No.
Luckily, they're passing by, deep in conversation, and don't notice her. She follows them down an almost never-ending spiral staircase, listening to them talk about a war and a fearless general that is also here and running out of supplies. At the bottom of the stairs, she sees the corpses of Chimera laid out on slabs and a fog of incense in the air. As she examines the bodies, she notices they have hamas exactly like hers on their hands, or paws, in the case of the elephant bear, his front feet. Karoo examines one more closely, a handsome white-haired male with the paws and fur and feet of a white wolf. As she is studying his hamas, she realises he's not dead. He springs to life and snarls, "Who are you?" Since she's never been able to properly answer that question, she screams instead. Reasonable reaction.
Reasonable response. Akiva, meanwhile, is interrogating Azeel and Razgut for information about the girl with the Hamsas. He has taken Azeel and his terrible burden up to a high parapet. Azeel reveals her name is Karoo and that she is Brimstone's adopted daughter / errand girl who showed up one day as a baby, but not much more than that. Then they have a conversation about what makes monsters, finding your soul, killing a lot of innocents, and stringing teeth to make necklaces. When Akiva tires of trying to get information out of the grave robber, and listening to Razgut's constant murmuring of, "Take me home, brother!" He threatens to kill Aziel, but Aziel is done talking, so he throws himself from the parapet.
Whoa.
Serious. That is serious.
Whoa.
Take me home, brother. Oh, brother. Just the whole time muttering in your ear. Take me home.
Do you get a little bit of a baby Lord Voldemort feel from him? Because that's what I always did.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe a little less fetus-like.
A little less fetus-like. More like, you know, in Hellboy, when they've got the, he's got the dead body on his back.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It's like a cross between those two.
Yeah, okay.
Cool. Okay. So Karu is rescued from the White Wolf by Brimstone. But rescue might not be the right word.
I don't think
he's furious. He roughly drags Karu up the stairs and throws her through the door and into the shop. He yells at her and Issa and Yasri. Karu should never have gone through that door. They agreed that if they were to keep her here and safe, that she should never be seen by anyone on the other side. He asks if the wolf Iago saw her hands, her hamsters, and she has to tell him yes. He throws her out of the shop into the snow and slams the door behind her. She has no coat, no shoes and sword wounds and has to walk to her flat. Upon arrival, she realises she doesn't have her keys or any wishes stronger than Scuppy's to wish her way inside. Dang. Just then, she's grabbed from behind. Reacting on instinct, she throws the person through the plate glass of her apartment building.
As you do.
I mean, it solves the problem of her getting inside, at least. But the attacker wasn't an attacker. It was Kaz, who spits, "What are you?" at her. Like, what? Not who this time.
Well, that's different.
I mean, at least. I mean, that's two things that's sort of going on our side. She can get in the house now. So she goes to her flat, breaks in, and sobs. Susanna arrives a few days later and Karu tells her everything. Like, really, everything. The true story. But guess what? Susanna doesn't believe. Until that is, that a burning Kishmish carrying the wishbone Brimstone always wore around his neck flies inside and dies in Karu's arms.
And then Karu, we need to excuse Amanda because she's a sobbing mess. If she had emotions. But she doesn't, so...
There was like 1/5 of an 1/8.
Yeah, small amount.
If you took a pencil nib and just...
Yeah.
Cool. Karu and Susanna rush to the shop to find the door burning from the handprint scorched into it. Karu realises that all the portals to elsewhere, to Brimstone and Issa, and all her family are gone.
Wah. Ah. 3 months have passed since the portals burned. In that time, Karu learned that Brimstone has left her quite a bit of money and property all over the world. She uses that money to travel, normal person style, to find the terrible tooth traders and retrieve their unspent wishes. Bane, the burly bearded winking trader who earlier earned 2 Gavriels, is relieved of his wishes at gunpoint. Because Karu is badass. Inside his grizzly, greasy beard, Karu finds several shings, lucknows, which are one step up from a shing, and 2 Gavriels. She uses a shing to wish him to sleep, then uses a Gavriel to give herself the power of flight and takes off. This time to find Aziel. Surely he'll have answers she needs. Either he will or Razgut will.
I'll have your answers. Taste you.
That's so disgusting.
Brother!
Karu arrives to learn that Aziel killed himself to protect her from the angel. But Razgut survived the fall. He survived a much greater fall than that 1,000 years ago when he fell from heaven or was cast out. So all this plummet, it was nothing really. It's a bit of a trip.
It's nothing. 1,000 years ago. I plummeted from heaven.
I like Razgut.
I'm surprised you haven't gone, like, amalgamated it with the ducky.
No, not this time, brother.
Next time.
Cool. He tells Karu that he knows a way she can see Brimstone again. There is another portal that the angels didn't destroy. The same one he fell from. Good thing Karu can fly now. Unfortunately, she has to use her other Gravril to wish Razgut the power of flight as well. Because she has to take him along.
Mm.
But not yet. She's got a puppet show to go to first.
So much more important.
Exactly. Exactly. Puppets first. Meanwhile in Prague, Akiva has found Karu's flat. He has the first page of the sketchbook that was left with all the rest of her things when she was thrown from Brimstone's shop. The page with her address on. I mean, I know you want to make your property back, but that's just dangerous.
Yeah, put a fake address on. Like a post office box. Get a P.O. box. Don't use your real address.
Or like the place you're always hanging out. I'm sure the bar staff wouldn't mind. Anyways. So he's been waiting for days for her, but she hasn't been seen. She's been busy gathering wishes and preparing for her trip with Razgut, but now she's finally on her way home. She's got to be there for Susanna's puppet show.
Back in her flat, Akiva still watches Karu. He can't hurt her. He's got an odd feeling about her. She reminds him of a girl he once loved. A chimera girl with beautiful wings and gazelle horns. An angel loving a chimera? How is that possible? They are sworn enemies. However it happened, we know, but we're not telling you yet, Akiva misses how the girl, Madrigal, would kiss the death tally tattoos on his fingers and talk about how all they knew was war, but they had to make something out of it. That girl is gone, and has been for a long time. Why does this new girl, Karu, whose name means hope, remind him so much of his beloved Madrigal? Why indeed?
Susanna's puppet show is achingly beautiful. So it's not the Muppets then. I'm slightly disappointed. Karu gifted her with a vintage ballerina costume and did her makeup. And Mick, the boy Zeus had a crush on, who is now her adorable boyfriend, plays the violin while she dances as if she is the puppet under the arms of a giant puppeteer puppet. It's reverse puppeteering, and it's just perfect. Karu has had a bad feeling all day, and after Suzanne's performance, it comes back again. She is certain she is being watched. She sneaks through the streets of Prague, across bridges and down alleys, pretending fear. Her pursuer is getting close. She stops at a nook and is startled to find Svetla there, dressed as a vampire in Kaz's tour, fluffy eyebrows hidden. She snarls at Karu, who promises to fix her eyebrows if she'll just shut up. In the shadows of the alley, Karu sees wings and springs from her hiding place, one hands out with a knife in the other hand and attacks. The angel barely fights back and promises not to hurt her. Too bad she doesn't have her fancy crescent moon blades that she bought when buying Susanna's gift, but the hamsters work well enough. To stop her from attacking, the angel flies up in the air, saying he just wants to talk. And Karu, launching herself from a perfect superhero pose, flies up next to him.
They circle in the air, drawing a gawking crowd below. Including, but not limited to, Kaz, who watches up jealously. Akiva holds Karu's hands together, keeping the hamsters concealed, and tummy butterflies erupt inside Karu. What is this feeling, and why is it happening? This guy, this beautiful angel, is her enemy. The Hamsas prove it. He tells her about the Hamsas, that they are the marks of revenants, chimera soldiers, and they are the only ones that have them. He tells her about Brimstone and the others being in the Black Fortress, the place she saw earlier through the second doorway, and that they burned the portals to stop the war. He releases her hands and backs away, but quickly moves toward her again. Bad idea! Her hands fly up in protection and he tumbles to the ground. She lands next to him to a surge of applause and ushers him away so they can talk.
Back in her flat, Akiva tells Karu about the war and how he is a soldier bred only to fight, named Akiva because another Akiva died and the name opened up. The war, that's really harsh, isn't it?
It's bad. It's not good. It's not good.
No. The war has been going on for 1,000 years, chimera against angels, enemies forever. The angels gave the beasts light and technology in the written word, but then made them slaves and treated them like garbage. No one is surprised that they got tired of being oppressed and rose up to fight.
Not a single person should not be surprised by this.
No, it should be expected, to be fair.
Yeah.
So Akiva came here to close the portals, to stop the sorcerer Brimstone's magic, but stayed because people were not fighting and free to grow old. Also because he saw a girl with dark eyes and jewel hair, and he wanted to know what it would be like to make her smile. And we swoon.
Yeah, we do.
Then his wings unfurl, and he falls asleep. So Karu sketches him. Oh.
Yeah.
Draws him for hours, in fact, until she falls asleep too. She wakes up to see him looming over her, her crescent blades in his hands. But he was just looking at them. They get breakfast buns from a bakery and watch the sunrise from the top of a cathedral. Karu kicking her feet from the edge. Akiva is memorised by Karu's simple joys. She explains that she only wished for flight a few days ago, so she is still enjoying it. They talk of other wishes she has made, and then Akiva reveals the cost of using magic is pain.
The itchy butt crack is looking a little petty right about now, I think. Whose pain is it? Kaz's, because I'm sure that itchy butt crack got painful after a while.
It does! It does!
Mm. Mm. At a tea house, Akiva tells her more of his story, more about the war. She keeps her Hamsas hidden, wrapped around her teacup, and his hands are the same. She looks at his tattoos there, the Chimera death tally, and has a flash of what seems like an old memory, and says, "You have more now." What? Akiva is just as startled as she is. She's always had a feeling like something wasn't quite right. Like she was someone else, meant to be doing something else. Like Karu isn't even her name, and it's happening again right now. Akiva spills his tea, and the waitress who cleans it up tells Karu she's been on TV all morning, and asks how they were flying. Karu simply said they were flying. She calls Susanna, who is a tiny ball of rage at Karu's flying disappearance, and she comes to the tea house. She meets Akiva and immediately wants to mate with him.
It's so awkward.
Mick will be fine with this, surely. She can see that Akiva and Karu have a thing, but Karu insists they are enemies. Zeus informs Karu that the police are after them for their flying fight, so Karu decides now is the time to fly through the portal with Razgut. But Akiva is coming too, to keep her safe.
I do not know of any laws against defying gravity.
I was about to say, the law of gravity.
Well, you've got the law of gravity, yes. But human laws, there are none. So what would she be arrested on?
Disturbing the peace.
Living statues disturb my peace, but they're not arrested.
No.
Let the girl fly. Before they go, they spend the rest of the day in Prague with Susanna and Mick. On the bridge, where Susanna had her performance, she and Mick make out, and Akiva almost kisses Karu. They talk about the war being all that there is in the other world, and that Karu doesn't have to go and Akiva will stay with her. She pulls the wishbone out, thinking of Brimstone and how she has to find him. But when Akiva sees it, he falls to his knees, crying, wings unfurling, and tells Karu he knows who she is.
It's kind of big, because she doesn't know who she is.
This is huge!
Kind of a big
bombshell deal. On yeah. The bridge.
Yeah.
Before they can talk more, Haziel and Liriaz approach them on the bridge. They're more like family to Akiva and have come to see why he disappeared. So after the last battle at Loramendi, he had to get away. They know there is something about Karu. They have suspicions, but Akiva pretends she's just a human, pushing her behind his wings to talk to the other angels in their own language. However, Karu, unbeknownst to Akiva, uses a look now to wish herself the language of the Seraphim and steps around him, threatening to show the angels her hands. Akiva has a choice. Does he stand with his family or with Karu? Karu, he chooses Karu and tells her to leave, but to wait for him before going through the portal with Razgut.
I really love that scene.
So do I.
Like, you don't expect her to use a wish to learn a language. Come on, it's one of her favorite things to collect. So, of course, she's going to wish herself this language and just waltz out from behind like, oh, you, you're talking about my hands and you want to see them? Okay.
Yes, I do like that scene a lot.
Now Akiva remembers when he made another difficult decision. Lying near death on a beach after the battle at Bullfinch, he's just killed a lizard hyena chimera who has very nearly killed him, too. He's on the ground, waiting for death, but a chimera girl shows up instead. She's carrying a staff and has crescent moon blades. She's part girl, part bat, part gazelle. And she puts a tourniquet on his wound and leads the other chimera away. Before leaving, though, they have a moment. They joke about living and dying. She recommends living, and then she leaves. Laraz shows up not long after, asking who helped him, but he says he doesn't know. Now, in present day, Laraz tries to go after Karu, but Akiva stops her. Hazael breaks up their fight, but Laraz is very upset at being stabbed in the back. Metaphorically, of course, because Akiva would never hurt her. And then he tells them both that Madrigal, a chimera, saved his life and he fell in love with her. Scandal, my pearls! Scandal them! Oh my! Oh my indeed! My pearls!
He remembers going back to Astria, where the Seraphim rule from, taken back from the Chimera to be seen by the healers. He learns of the magic once used by the Magi before they were all murdered and secretly begins to wield it, using his pain from his battle wound as payment. He learns to make himself invisible and learns the language of the Chimera. One day he will see his Chimera girl again. He also learns to use his other arm in battle and now uses dual blades and earns the attention of his father, Joram, the leader of the Seraphim, who has legions of children, who talks about his mother in an unfavourable way. She was a different kind of Seraphim, a Stellian, the outliers from the Far Isles who used magic. Akiva seems to think there's a better way of living, and now, back in the present, he's flying to meet Karu with her wishbone in his hand. Akiva knows that if Karu learns what's inside it, she'll hate him forever.
They meet in Morocco. Karu has been waiting for days and purchased gloves to hide her hamsas so she can touch Akiva. When he finally arrives, pretending to be surly, he tells Karu that they're going to break the wishbone so she can finally learn who she is. They go to her rented room, and after a passionate kiss and shared I love yous, they break the wishbone. Karu is filled and complete. Her past life has joined with her present. She is Karu. She was Madrigal. She was in love with Akiva then, too, and because of it, she was accused of treason and sentenced to death by beheading and to evanescence. Her soul would not be saved. But she had a plan. After her death, she would save Akiva.
Madrigal was of high human aspect, meaning she had a human face and torso, and she was therefore very beautiful. She had also never been killed and then resurrected by Brimstone. She has no hamas on her hands. Those came after Brimstone brought you back to life. Madrigal had been working with Brimstone, learning his trade, which was very rare. Thiago, the White Wolf, the son of the Warlord, wanted to marry Madrigal for her purity. Madrigal's adopted sister, Chiro, was of creature aspect and was jealous of Madrigal for being desired by Thiago, but not sure what to do about it. Madrigal couldn't tell if she liked Thiago or if she was afraid of him, but Chiro came to get Madrigal ready for the ball, celebrating the Warlord.
Madrigal thought about her childhood, growing up, being lucky enough to have been chosen instead of Chiro to be a page and then apprentice to Brimstone. She learned that teeth and gemstones strung together created the bodies of the Chimera, and that when they died in battle, their souls were gleaned with incense into thuribles and held until a new body was ready. Brimstone taught her all about the teeth, choosing the right ones, but he taught by example, not by words. She helped resurrect Chiro once, made a body exactly like the one she had before, but Chiro was angry at first because she still had the head of a jackal, was still creature aspect, but Madrigal made her perfectly. She also learned that magic works because of pain, and that is what really brought everything together. The teeth paid that pain, and the Chimera's previous death was used to create Hamsas on their hands to protect them from the Seraphim. The Seraphim. She still thinks of that one she saved on the battlefield, blushing when she does. If only Madrigal had died in battle. After all, death is just death. A body is just a body. Then she wouldn't have been chosen by Thiago. As long as her soul wasn't allowed to evanesce, Brimstone could bring her back. But no! She has no Hamsas. She is pure. And now she's masked and dusted in sugar and going to the ball.
There was a parade of sorts along the way to the ball, where all the masked Chimera danced with one another and kissed each partner before passing along to someone else. No one would dance with Madrigal, though. Everyone she knew was Thiago's. No one except the man in the horse mask. He dances with her all the way to the doors and tells her he knows who she is but doesn't know her name and that she saved his life. She immediately knows. The horse is the angel. He must be a fool for coming here. I mean, he's surrounded. He's in the belly of the beast, the den of the Chimera. I mean, come on, you know? He has no friends here. But he didn't come here to assassinate the warlord. He only came here for her. Oh, but she tells him to leave, for he'll surely be found out and tortured and killed. The Madrigal was approached by Chiro, and then they saw Thiago and the angel horse disappeared into the crowd. There was another dance, so Madrigal whisked herself away from Thiago to dance more with strangers. This time, the angel horse was a tiger instead. He asked her if she intended to marry Thiago, if she loved him. But love, she said, is a luxury. No, he replied, it's an element. The dance ended, and Madrigal was passed to Thiago, and the tiger disappeared.
During the next dance, Thiago sleazed on Madrigal. After all, in his mind, he owned her. Gross. He commented on her dress, then broke the collar of it, so it fell open, and he conveniently had to hold it up by pressing his hand above her breast.
I mean, so angry at this part, I'm just saying.
It's so awful. Luckily, she was swapped to another dance partner, and then another, the angel wearing a goofy human face. He noticed her broken dress and got angry, then called hummingbird moths to Madrigal's shoulders to cover her. She laughed, and Chiro noticed. Luckily, the fireworks began after that, and the two were able to sneak away to a hidden garden to kiss and make love. They came to each other for a month, breaking wishbones each time before they departed to wish for another evening together. Then they started planning for their future. But they were discovered. Bum, bum, bum.
Now, briefly back with Karu and Akiva, they declare their love for each other. Karu is magical. She's complete again, and she is so happy to see that Akiva is still alive. When her head was cut off and Akiva screamed and screamed and kept on screaming, Madrigal had a plan to save him. I mean, to be fair, I think his reaction is absolutely spot on, and I don't, like, own that dude, own that, because I would be screaming as well.
Yeah, just never stop. Just never stop screaming.
Exactly. So Madrigal had a plan to save him. A week before being caught, Thiago returned from the battle he had left for the day after the ball, and Madrigal knew that Chiro had become suspicious. In her cell, Brimstone told her he couldn't save her, and she knew it. She apologised for shaming him, but he told her he was not ashamed and she should not be sorry for falling in love. He said they will never win the war with the Seraphim until they had something new and that they both hoped for the same thing. He also informed her that Chiro was the one who told on them for Thiago's promise of high human aspect the next time she died. Brimstone wouldn't allow that, of course. He said he had eel teeth waiting for her now, and that is a vindictiveness that I can truly get behind.
I love it.
But he also told Madrigal that some souls were weak and could be pushed aside. When Thiago came to take her to the beheading, Brimstone informed him that Chiro would come to watch over her evanescence, and he left her cell with a smile.
When Madrigal was beheaded, Chiro, apologizing for what she had done, Madrigal pushed her soul, her being, inside Chiro's body, and walked to Akiva's cell to set him free. And he killed her. Karu had no idea how Brimstone had found her and gleaned her soul, but it didn't matter. She and Akiva are together again, and they are going through the portal to find Brimstone, and they will work together to bring about the end of war. Except, no. Akiva, when he burned his handprint into the last doorway to Brimstone's shop, had gone inside and to the Black Fortress in Loramendi and killed them all before taking Karu's sketchbook with her address and finding her. She left Akiva when he told her that. Left him, but didn't kill him. Left him to find Razgut and go with him through the portal into Loramendi to stop the war. Ooh. Friggin' yikes!
It's one way to end a book. What a cliffhanger.
Yikes. Yikes.
Shall we take a moment to absorb the yikes?
Yeah, I guess we better. Ugh. Please remember that Fictional Hangover is a free podcast and always will be. If you'd like to support the show, stop listening to us for just a few minutes. Become a patron of ours on Patreon at patreon.com/fictionalhangover, then come back. If you can't do this monthly but still want to support us because you just like the show so much, head over to Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/fictionalhangover to drop us a one-time tip. Your support on Patreon and Ko-fi will help us bring you more spoiler-filled discussions, book character cosplays, and ridiculous content you know and love. Now, back to the episode. Okay, so, oh my gosh. I love this book too much.
You can't love a book too much. I deny that statement. You can take that statement back.
I love it too much. It's so good. I love everything about it.
Can you talk about it without spoiling the other two books in the series?
Yes.
Okay.
So, were there any standout moments for you?
I want to know what stood out for you. I'm going to turn the tables here, missus. Turning the tables. You've read this book a million times, but you've had it since first print, so you've had it for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
What did you, when you first read it, what stood out for you then, and has that changed from what stands out now?
That's a hard question to answer, really, because, I mean, the first time I read it was 10 years ago, so I don't really remember what stood out to me, although I did immediately start dressing up as Karu for things, so I think I just loved her as a character more than I loved anything else, and now I lean heavily towards Zuzana. I really, really like Zuzana and her, you know, being a tiny ball of rage.
You relate to her on a fundamental level, don't you?
I do. And all of her puppetry that she does. I just really like Zuzana.
Do you like Karu's story or Madrigal's storyline? They are the same person, I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're very different people.
I like both of their stories.
Who would you rather go out to dinner with?
Probably Madrigal, but that would be so I can stare at her horns to perfectly recreate a pair.
Would you ask to touch them?
Yeah. But like, I would wait a little bit, you know, until we're like actually, you know, friends before I just reach up and want to touch her horns, because I feel like that can be offensive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you've got to ask permission as well.
Right.
I always quite like it. Like, I've known a couple of people who've had reconstructive surgery on their breasts after having them removed
mm-hmm.
for medical reasons. And my favourite was when I was, it was a lady I used to work with, and I walked into the toilets at work and she just stuck her boobs out at me, top on, and just like, feel them, Claire, feel them. And she was like, okay. And then you do it, you're like, oh, hey, they're really good. Can I have another go? And then you go, ha ha.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't honk Madrigal's horns like you would honk a bosom.
No, they are very different, like, parts of the body.
Yeah. I mean, you can't really honk them. You'd have to stroke them.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like you could waterboard them either.
No, that would be dangerous. That would hurt, I think.
And weird.
They're probably kind of sharp.
Yeah. Really long.
Yeah. So I've been Karu and Madrigal before in the past, and I had a lovely pair of gazelle horns that I made, but I gifted them to my tiny Zuzana, who played my Zuzana when I was Madrigal. And I gifted them to her because she needed them. Because also like Zuzana, my tiny stand-in Zuzana barely scrapes 5 feet tall in real life. She's tiny and pocket-sized. She's adorable.
She's travel size for convenience.
She is. She really is.
Oh. I've seen the picture of you. You have posted it previously.
Yeah.
And it is fantastic cosplay. The wings aren't on the picture, though, are they?
No, I had to take the wings off because they were fully extended and I kept hitting people.
Yeah.
Well, I did. I had them. Like, I had a way where I could pull them down and tuck them. But they're better fully extended. I mean, I had probably a 10 or 12 foot wingspan when I wore them. And
wow.
It was dangerous. So I had to take them off. Also, it was in like a grassy field where we were. And there were lots of like holes in the grassy field. And I was wearing giant weird hooves. And I kept toppling over anyway, as if I was a newborn baby gazelle falling down. So I lost the wings. And that helped.
But you learned a valuable wing-making lesson that day.
Yes.
Good. Good.
Yes. That was the first pair of wings I ever built. So wings are better now.
Wings are hard.
Wings are hard.
Especially if you get them where you can, like, pull the cords and they extend out. And, you know, if the mechanism breaks on them. And you've got one wing that's all floppy and another wing that's sticking up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, cosplay fail.
The only wings I have now are not extendable. Yeah. They are resting wings. And that's more reasonable for getting around.
You've come up with some fantastic phrases today. Oh, this is beautiful.
So I love both of them. What I was getting at with that is that I love both of them so much that I have dressed up as them before.
Excellent. Times. So I'm gonna guess your standout moments are featuring Zuzana and or Karu?
Yeah, of course. I mean, when Zuzana meets Akiva in the tea house, I love that scene because it's so awkwardly ridiculous. But luckily, Akiva doesn't understand what she's saying, so it's not so terrible that she's saying that she has to mate with him immediately and talking about his widow's peak and how she's gonna sacrifice her body to have a million babies with Akiva so she can put widow's peaks back in the world again. That's
haven't
less
we
awkward.
All had that conversation?
We probably have. We probably have, but I feel like it would have been more awkward if Akiva knew what she was saying.
I think he would have been straight out of the door and getting a restraining order on her.
Probably. Like, probably he would have.
Do you know, apart from that entire scene being completely delightful and wonderful, I quite like that it was the girl being the sexual predator in that rather than the other way around, because it's so often it's the men. Like the trader, when he gives that horrible wink to Karu and it's just disgusting and greasy and horrible and just it's just not nice, it's nasty, it's like don't do it.
Yeah,
but for a change you've got the female being hyper sexual and like, yeah, I'm just gonna have his babies, he just needs to get on the floor right now. Yep. And let's get the widow pigs back in the world.
Yeah,
it makes a change for it being the woman being the sexual predator.
You know, it's not okay.
In a good way. In a consensual way.
Yeah, it's not okay to be a sexual predator. Male or female, or however you choose to present yourself, it's not okay to be a sexual predator. I think we should just throw that in. We do not approve of sexual predating. Yep.
No. Predating. Predating. Consent, people. Don't be a creep. Get consent.
Ask before you can be impregnated by someone.
And no means no.
Even when widow's peaks are involved.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm glad we've established that.
Yeah, yikes. What else?
That common sense fact.
Let's see. I also really liked when, after the portals are burned, and Karu is just like, well, I have to go and get my family back, so I'm going to go and track down every single person who came to see Brimstone and steal all their wishes at gunpoint.
It's a rip-roaring revenge.
It really is, and it doesn't last that long.
No.
But you know that she's gone to several different people, and now she has lots of wishes that she's prepared to use to find Brimstone.
I always get like a Kill Bill kind of moment out of that.
Yeah.
You can see the bride being the one who goes around and just kicking ass, but in this case she's got blue hair and not a yellow tracksuit.
Yeah, right. Right. But I really like that. But cutting the wishes out of that guy's greasy beard, no. Mm-mm. Gross.
If you're gonna have a beard, please have good beard maintenance. Ugh. Don't be a gross beard person.
Ugh.
Groom. Product.
Ugh. Yeah.
Comb. Trim. Watch Queer Eye on Netflix. They teach you how to have a good beard.
Yeah, but ugh, no. Can't imagine digging around in that guy's beard, pulling coins out. Ugh.
No.
Gross, I just got chills. Ugh. And I'm not a fan of body hair, so this is like doubly gross for me, digging around like a monkey and you're looking for mites. And you're just digging in a beard and pulling out treasures.
At least you're groomed daily.
Not this
How
guy.
How big must it be able to knock them in there like that?
I mean, pretty big.
Ugh.
Because some of those are pretty big.
So unhygienic.
Yeah. Yeah, but I feel like the Gabriels are pretty big. Maybe not quite saucer-sized, but still, like, that's a...
Yeah.
That's a big thing that you've got tied into your beard.
I always kind of imagine them being like, you know, commemorative coins. They've got that kind of big chunky weight to them, and they're oversized. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the smaller they are, the smaller the stone is. Or
yeah, I feel like I imagine the scuppies as actual beads, like very small that you can string onto things.
Yes.
But you know, as they get bigger, they turn into more of a coin look than the beads.
Yeah. I kind of go in like, the beads, and then the next size up, kind of like, you know, when you see the gem pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. And then that's when they start flattening off after that. Yeah. Oh, God, I'm just imagining the beard. I feel sick.
Yeah, it's gross. It's real gross. Let's stop talking about it. Another one of my favorite scenes.
Please tell me, please. Let's move on.
Well, I don't know if it's better.
It's moving on.
The first scene, setting everything up, and you're meeting all of Karu's, like everyone around her, and you're learning all about her, and then she wishes for an itchy butt crack. It's just a perfect setup, and everything about it is fantastic. I love it.
It's a subtle revenge, isn't it? But it's very effective.
Ugh, yeah, and he's just up there sexually posing on purpose to torture Karu, and then he has an itchy butt crack.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, guy. That's what you get.
Here's your embarrassingly itchy butt crack. Down his face, the pain takes over.
Yes, yes.
Do you remember in Mallrats, the pretzel scene?
No, I haven't seen Mallrats.
There's a scene in Mallrats where one of the characters is offered chocolate-covered pretzels.
Mm-hmm.
But the chocolate-covered pretzels, beforehand, he's kind of stuck his hand up. The guy who offered them stuck his hand up his butt.
No.
To basically get butt smell and then put them all on the chocolate-covered pretzels.
Ew, no.
So then he offers the chocolate-covered pretzels. He takes them, eats them, which is gross enough as it is. But then the smell's on his hand. And the whole joke is that that smell doesn't come off easy. You can wash with soap and water half a dozen times, but that smell lingers. And that's kind of what I was thinking with the itchy butt crack, that even after the itchy butt's kind of like abated, he's probably had a good rake and his hand's going to fucking stink.
Yeah. Yeah, that's gross. I told you. Yeah. I told you the next thing that I wanted to talk about wouldn't be better than the grizzly gross beard. An itchy smelly butt crack? No.
Itchy smelly butt crack is a little bit easier for me to go with than the gross beard.
It's just all, it's all bad.
It's all bad. It's all
terrible,
it's
in
all
a great
unhygienic
way.
It's all unhygienic.
Yeah.
Let's get some hand sanitizer in here. Come on. We've all got some.
Yeah. I did love that they called it cranny. Instead of a butt crack, it was a cranny. But cranny itches. I enjoyed that. Those are my favorite things. Do you have any favorite things? Do you have any standout moments?
It's kind of like standout moments and standout things. For all the fact that Kaz is an absolute douche, I love the fact he's got a vampire tour.
Yes.
And
it used to be a ghost tour, which is also great.
Which I'm totally there for. I would be happy. I would absolutely love to be one of those tour people who dresses up and has to overact.
Yeah.
I love it. I've been on loads of them as well in different cities and places. Edinburgh, York, London, I've done them. There's a few other places I've done these things and I absolutely adore them because it's not fiction. There is a bit of fiction. I've done fictional tours as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great one in Edinburgh where it's a book tour. And I just like the fact that it's all this fact dumped in there. And even if it's a ghost one or even if it's a vampire one, there's fact mixed in with the mythology. And I think it's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And when they're gimmicky, I just adore it. I absolutely adore it. So the fact that Kaz has this vampire previously ghost tour, I'm all over it. And I wish it was run and operated by a nicer person.
With a less itchy butt crack.
With a less itchy butt crack, I'm not shaking his hand after the tour.
It's only temporary. It's only a temporary butt itch, though, so.
How temporary is temporary?
I think probably just enough to get him out of the classroom.
Do you think? I would like it to last on for a few days. Like, it starts to recede. You know when you've got the hiccups and you think they're finally going away,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden they start back up again?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I want that to happen because the guy's a dick.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so you want itchy hiccups?
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah, why not?
Good.
So for all the fact he is a douche, I like the fact he's got gimmicky tours.
Yeah.
The jump from the parapet, fucking yikes, man.
Yeah, yikes. Yikes indeed.
I did not think he was going to do it.
I didn't think
he was going to jump.
Yeah,
I mean, it was, the signs were there, but I didn't know he was definitely going to do it. So that's probably a surprise, actually. It's probably my big surprise from the book.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, really, what does he owe her so much that he would kill himself before saying anything about her? I mean,
exactly.
I feel like it probably has to do with constantly being muttered at by Razgut, and he's just like, fuck it all. And Razgut's like, no! Don't jump off the parapet, brother. And then he's like, just fuck everything.
Yeah.
Because before that, when he was talking to Karu, like, Azeel broke down and was begging her, like, you're the only person I know who I can ask this. Please pull out all your teeth and wish this creep away. And she's like, no, I'm not going to pull out all my teeth for that terrible wish. No, thank you. And then he jumps off the parapet.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It sets up the fact that he is plumb sick of Razgut.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is that huge factor. He's essentially killed himself to save Karu.
Yeah, which, and then from Carew to Brimstone, which I feel like, you know, he owes Brimstone quite a bit for all the wishes and all the payments and stuff that he's gotten over the years.
Yeah, I mean, but it was very, like, transactional. Like, I'll give you this, you give me that. It's commercial trade of goods.
Yeah.
So, from that aspect, I can understand not necessarily being indebted to Brimstone, per se. It was more, it's more the sacrifice. It was just that, I mean, I'm linking it, this in as a standout moment, as also as, like, my biggest surprise from the book,
mm-hmm.
was his sacrifice. Because I would not have been surprised if he'd kind of spilled his guts. But he didn't.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy situation. It's not a situation where he was being tortured, you know. He still kept his mouth shut. And he kind of redeemed himself in that kind of few minutes.
Yeah. I guess Carew was probably one of the only people that was nice enough to visit with him and buys him tea whenever she goes to collect all of the human teeth from him. And they, like, sit and chat for a while. So I guess it's probably another reason why I wanted to keep her safe, because she kind of genuinely cared for him.
Yeah, it wasn't as if she was doing it because it was part of the transaction. Like, Brimstone said to her, you need to go and sweeten the guy up, or, you know, it wasn't like she does that for everybody, she doesn't.
Yeah.
And that kind of, for me, it really says that if you're nice to people, just be nice to people, because you don't know what shit they're going through.
Yeah.
Like, people couldn't see Razgut. They didn't know Razgut was there constantly muttering and being this horrible burden on his back.
Yeah.
And in his mind. And it's quite symbolic of a lot of health problems that people have in that kind of situation, that you don't know what people are going through. So just be nice to everybody, you know. Yeah. Reach out to the people who might seem a little bit lonelier. And for goodness sake, the guy is a grave robber. I can't be a particularly social occupation.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thought it was quite beautiful, that bit as well. Like, their relationship was really, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did enjoy that. And that's why I was a bit, now we're talking through it, probably less surprised that he sacrificed himself for her. Now that we're talking about it, it kind of is less surprising. But when you read the book, the first time I read the book, it was very surprising. And when I listened to it ready for recording, it wasn't until I got to the scene and I remembered. I went, oh, shit!
Yeah.
Because I remembered he dives. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to take a moment here for him. Because, you know, R.I.P. It was a beautiful moment. It really was. It was terrible, mm-hmm. but beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bit happy but sad. It's one of those where, I mean, he sacrificed himself, but he sacrificed himself ultimately for a friend.
Yeah.
And she doesn't realise how much of a friend she was until it's too late. So, you know, again, that's another message, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Okay. I feel like I've done that. That's kind of like, okay, I'm going to move on because I feel a little bit sad now. and go to the scene on the bridge. It's one of my favourite scenes. And it's the one where Akiva is protecting Carew. And we've already talked about it. She's like, what they're saying, make a wish. I can speak Seraphim now. You think what, bitch? You want to say what? No. I don't know if it was the best thing to do, Carew, mind. You know, make the wish, learn the language. But I think at that stage, it probably would have been better to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, probably it would have. Probably it would have, especially when Akiva, you know, he's pushing her behind him and he tells her in her own language, or in the language of Chimera, to, like, hey, you need to stay back here and don't let them see your hands. Don't, you know, they don't need to know who you are, so just stay back here. So you would think that she would probably think more about, these guys are probably my enemies and I should probably stay quiet, but no. Nope.
Yeah.
Walks out. Oh, what's this? What's this about my hands? Here you go. Yeah, yes.
That's something we've all kind of wanted to do, we've all talked about or thought about doing, you know, it's like, you know, but...
Yeah, like, you know, you know another language and you hear people talking badly about you and you just want to be like, excuse me, what? Yeah, I speak your language. You're being a douche. Stop it.
Yes. As somebody who is not literate in any other language and very jealous of that fact, anybody who can speak more than one language, bravo. Honestly, I hold my hands up and think you're a genius. It's amazing. I can't pick up a second language. My French teacher on the day of my oral exam told me how bad my French accent was. So I'm just not very good with language. I do try. People have tried, but I'm just not language orientated, unfortunately. So when you hear people talking and you kind of, I wish I had that ability to wish a language and then be like, excuse me, what?
Yeah.
I would use my wishes for languages. It's definitely one of those things. If I had those scuppies, I would be wishing for a million languages, honestly.
I think it takes more than a scuppy. Unless you're learning an itchy language. Because now, forever in my head, scuppies are only about itches. Nothing else. Even when she uses one to become quiet. Quiet itches. Everything is itchy.
Everything is itchy. You're quiet, but you could have a scratch.
Yeah. But it's quiet, don't worry. It's not like a...
You know for a fact you'll have that inconvenient nose itch. I've got my crescent blades in my hand. I can't scratch right now.
Yeah.
The little thing.
Yeah. I feel like that's like, you know, wishes cost pain. You have to pay pain to use wish. And I feel like it's a itchy pain for scuppies.
Yeah, I think you're right. Do you know what itch pain I absolutely hate?
What?
Arch of your foot.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when you start or you're driving.
Yeah, that's bad. And you have to, like, rub your foot on anything in the bottom of the car.
Yes. But you can't. And it's just, go.
Because you've got your shoe on, like, you can't get around it. Yeah, it's a terrible itch.
And you're going 70 miles an hour, and there's nowhere to pull over, and then the eyes start watering.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bad itch. That's a bad that's itch a to have.
Horrible itch.
Yeah.
That's the next one Kaz can have after his itchy butt crack.
Yes. Yes.
But yes, the scene on the bridge where it's Akiva with Karu versus Haziel and Liraz. Beautiful. It's movie style. Like, I can see these three seraphim facing off, well, two and one, facing off against each other, their huge wings, lighting. Wet pith stones.
I think I would take it back just a few moments and add in where Akiva sees she pulls out Brimstone's wishbone that's been around her neck the whole time, but hey, it's not Brimstone's wishbone, it's her own wishbone and she just doesn't know it yet. And he sees it and he just immediately starts crying and falls to his knees and his wings pop out. Like, everything about that is beautiful. Everything about that scene is just completely, there's no other word. It's beautiful. There's no other word for it.
It's definitely a key moment as well.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful key moment in the entire story. I think part of the reason I like it is because it's such a majestic movie style backdrop and you can see the panning out and, you know, then the flying up into the air to escape, and you can visualize so well.
And if you know anything about Prague, which, you know, you do if you like this book so much and then you go and, like, read about the Charles Bridge. Like, it's a very beautiful place. And you just imagine this beautiful angel with his wings coming out and he's just sobbing. Finally, like, everything is, you know, he's thought the whole time that this has got to be Madrigal. This, she's so much like Madrigal, I just can't understand it. And then when he finally knows 100% for certain and just bursts into tears. It's just, I love it.
Yeah, it's the standout scene from the first time I read it as well. Like, it's the big scene I remember completely. Even before starting listening again, I didn't need to listen to it to remember that scene. It stood out for me from the first time I read it 10 years ago. I could intimately detail the entire scene.
I also
except
really...
pronouncing people's names.
Yeah, well, you've never been good at that, so
no,
it's normal. It's accepted. It's expected and accepted. Let's go back and talk about the bridge a little bit more. When Zuzana has her puppet show on the bridge, it meant more to me this time. I was thinking about it when you asked me about differences between the first time I read it and the most recent time. Like, I felt emotional in my
That's
way.
That's not you.
In
That's
my
not
way
you.
Of it halfway experiencing emotions. Like, when I can just imagine tiny Zuzana being a tiny, beautiful ballerina, and Mick is playing, like, sad music on his violin, and she's just being a puppet and doing a little ballet, and, you know, she's so sad, and then she tucks into a little trunk, and then it's over. Like, I would like to see that in real life.
Yeah. I'm really surprised these have not been adapted.
I know, everything about them. They're just freaking beautiful. Deal with it.
I would prefer, I think, possibly a TV series, because then it wouldn't lose so much of the nuance.
Yeah.
And you can see those two scenes as being very pivotal, like, scenes within particular episodes as well. And I wouldn't want those scenes to change. I would be very upset if they did. I think I would be upset if they had it in any other city other than Prague, perhaps. Possibly Eastern Bloc areas. There's a lot of gorgeous cities in that area, and full of history and beautiful architecture. However, Prague is one of those places as well that seems to make it in movies and things because of, like, what must be tax breaks or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Movie finance things. So I can see it being even possible to film it where it should be. You know?
At least that scene. I mean, I can't imagine them going to Marrakesh and going to Paris and going to every other location. Those will probably be sets, but I mean, if you don't go to the Charles Bridge, you're really missing out.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And places, movies, TV shows, they do that all the time, don't they? They'll have one set place and then you don't know that they're not in Marrakesh.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you know?
Exactly.
I feel like we need to stop talking about
Yes, I'm
going to
move on to the other beautiful scene, which is in the parade, like the carnival, going to the ball. Mm,
yeah.
I get a very New Orleans carnival style, but possibly a little bit more regalia, kind of like a bit more formal.
Yes.
More ball gowny.
Yes.
That was great. And I felt really, really sorry for Magical. Like, nobody wants to dance with her because the Argos girl.
Yeah, and she didn't even want to be there in the first place. And they've got her in this ball gown, freaking covered in sugar.
That is apart from it being sticky, I thought that was a huge creep factor as well.
Yeah. Well, Chiro and the other friend, I can't think of what her name is right now, they were jealous of her being coveted by Thiago. So, I mean, it's not like they were doing it to punish her, but they really wanted her to be wanted. And she was like, no, he's creepy. I don't want to be desired by this beast. He's a jerk. But no, he's the white wolf. He's the leader of the army.
He's so beautiful. He's so gorgeous. Oh my God.
So great.
You're so beautiful because you're a human. You've got a human face.
Yeah.
Bitch, you're a jackal. That's kick ass.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And you also have bat wings. Like, you're pretty awesome. Why would you want to have a human face if you could have a jackal face?
These are boring.
Yeah. But I guess if literally everyone around you also has a myriad of different animal faces, you'd probably be excited to have a human face. And, like, how's her speech? I know that speaking in their language is very, like, guttural, but
yeah,
you know, you got like a crocodile mouth or something. Like, how do you?
You can't. I don't think you'd be able to use your lips.
No, I guess it. But I guess it probably is. I guess it probably does take place inside more than outside. You know, it's very guttural and in the mouth rather than outside of the mouth, using lips to make sounds. So, I don't know. I'd use a luck now to learn that language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's on the list.
Yeah.
It's on the list of languages.
Yeah.
But what did you think of Akiva beat the ball?
I loved it. Especially now because of our weird obsession with horses and everything having a long face and everything being horse themed. When he shows up in a horse mask, I'm like, yes, I'm gonna make a new Why the Long Face button and add horse wings to it. In addition to the one I just made today that has a unicorn horn on it. We're gonna have a whole array of Why the Long Face pins and accessories with various types of horses.
To be fair, I'm surprised we haven't got a teeth one going yet. But I think it's only this book that's really highlighted the fact that you are obviously obsessed with teeth.
I don't know. I like beautiful books, and apparently every beautiful book that I like has teeth in it. I mean,
do you think you might have been a dentist in a past life?
I must have been. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
I feel like I'm going to be hyper aware now of any book that has teeth in it. I'd be like,
I know.
Is this one the one you recommended? A listener recommended? We saw, or I recommended? Because we need to start pointing fingers here.
Yeah, I've picked all the ones with teeth so far.
It's yeah. It's me. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I really liked when Akiva showed up wearing a horse mask. And then he disappears and comes back with a tiger mask. And then he disappears and comes back with like a goofy jughead human mask. And she's like, where do you keep getting these masks? Oh, you know, drunk people. They pass out and I steal their mask. What big deal? I could just imagining him like dispatching them. He's like doing a shoulder chop and then taking their mask off because
yoink.
Yeah, he's got to be doing something.
Oh, like a horse something. Mask.
Oh yeah.
I love it. He's gonna start it off with one mask. He has to have started off with the horse mask.
Yeah, he just had that one. He had it in his closet. And he
used it for a bachelor party years and years and years ago, and he's just never had another reason to use it since. But then there's this party, and it's all fancy dress, or, you know.
Yeah, and that mask was different from everyone else's mask, you know, because they were just, like, covering the front of the face, but his horse mask was a whole horse head that he put on. So it's different from everyone else's, so you know he had it. He already had it.
I'm a little upset now that when we started this call, you know where I'm going, that you didn't have your horse head on.
I know, I almost did. I almost really did put it on, but then I decided, no, I'm not going to do it. But I really did think about it. And let's just be truthful here. It's a donkey mask, not a horse mask, but it's friggin' close enough.
It's got a long face, and you can go, or you can make the horse pun jokes. It's fine.
Yeah.
We'll accept it. We'll allow it.
Yeah.
That's not going to be a cosplayer, is it?
No. Just
you sitting there with a mask.
No. Put on angel wings. No. I don't have angel wings.
Yet.
Although, it would be really great if I did, because the whole reason why I have that donkey mask in the first place is because of Supernatural and Misha Collins saying, hey, ass butt, and then that was a whole Gish thing, and the theme for that one, their representative was an ass butt, and it was a donkey with butterfly wings, and that's the whole reason why I have it. So if...
yeah, you need trench coat. You need wings. You need the horse head.
I have a trench coat. I need to make angel wings. Tis the season for angel wings. Yikes. What?
What have we done? What madness have we done?
I don't know. And you know I won't not accept an even halfway challenge of cosplay. So.
Yes.
Of course.
Getting back to the dance floor. Getting back to the dance floor. Can I rage for a second?
Of course you can. If it's about Thiago.
It's about Thiago. That. Rage.
He's gross.
He's gross. He's a self-important douchehead, but he's an absolute asshat when he breaks Madrigal's dress and then holds it up for her.
Yeah. Hand boob.
Hand boob. No. I mean, there's taking liberties. This is where we go back to no means no, consent people.
Yeah. Mm-mm. No.
Absolute
don't.
Creep. It was disgusting. It's hated gross. It. It was gross. I'm so angry. And fuck you, Thiago.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. It's bad. It's bad. But I did like then that Akiva used his magic that he is able to use now and calls the little moths to sit on her shoulders to keep her warm and to keep her bosoms shielded.
And then they start eating the sugar.
And then they start eating the sugar and she cracks up about it. And then they can't get them to leave. And he's like swiping moths away. I can just imagine their tiny little hummingbird moths like flying away through the air. And they're like, no, sugar, no, go back. But nope, flinging them off.
It's beautiful.
I imagine a boob popped out while she was doing that.
There's definite nip. And as beautiful as that scene would look theatrically with all those moths, can we get back to the fact that they're moths? And I would freak out.
Oh yeah, you don't like moths. You would not handle that well.
I don't like that. No, no. I'd be like, oh, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Stop it.
Yeah. Ugh. And then you're covered with tiny corpses.
Go wash the sugar off.
Yeah.
Put a nice big jumper on. Get your fluffy pajamas on. Nice big socks.
Well, you know, later on that evening, they do get rid of the sugar. In one way or another.
There is another way to get rid of the sugar.
Sexually. Sexual sugar remover.
It's not as kinky as you might think.
Sexual steampunk sugar licking. I don't know why it's steampunk. Sexual seraphim sugar licking. I had to come up with another S word. Seraphim fit perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost like it was in the book.
Almost as if it were there.
How convenient.
It is indeed.
Shall we move on to our favourite characters?
Yeah, I could talk about this book for hours and hours and hours.
That's fine.
I love Zuzana times a million.
Agreed.
Also, Brimstone.
Agreed.
And Issa and Karu and Madrigal and pretty much everyone, even Razgut, except for Thiago. And Chiro, yeah. I guess. She's a bitch.
She is.
She's a jackal
She's
bitch.
A mean girl.
She's but really, girl. I like all of them. They're all well written. They all have, you know, something.
They're very individual, aren't they? Like, you know, her family in the shop could... Different authors would not have potentially done as good a job. They might have been too interchangeable, but these all had very distinct personalities, very distinct attitudes, and roles in her life, which was good.
Yeah. I also really liked the way Christine Vam narrated this audiobook. She did a good job.
Excellent. It was an excellent audiobook narration. She sounds familiar as well. I need to check in to see if there's something else I've listened that she's done.
Yeah.
Because she's a very, very good, very clear narrator. Very distinct in the voices.
Yeah. I really enjoyed her Zuzana and her Brimstone. She did a good job with their voices. And Razgut, of course, which I've been mimicking the entire time.
You're learning through example.
I am. Although I feel like... Whenever I do a voice, it always, like, leans to that creaky, high-pitched sort of thing. So, that's one of my go-tos. Even around the house when I'm making up stories with things. It's always creaky.
I can imagine you walking across the floor going,
I've done my own sound effects in my house
all the time, and then you've got to do that quick backtrack and then the hop
I've done it.
I've done it. Yeah.
I think she did an excellent job, though. I love everything about the audiobook.
Yeah, I was intrigued by how she was going to voice Brimstone, if I'm honest. I wasn't sure. I think in my head, like, I kind of had a James Earl Jones style baritone bass, sort of.
Yeah.
He's
a very big character, so you know, he has to have a big voice as well.
Yeah, bassy. You know, you can imagine him with this big barrel chest. There's a lot of muscle and air capabilities there. And yeah, but she did an excellent job. I didn't think she diminished his physical presence through his voice. Does that make any sense? Like, he sounded exactly like he should.
Yeah, he really did. He really did.
Yeah.
Brimstone is just great.
Yeah. I kind of want a Granddaddy Brimstone.
Yeah, you
really
do.
With his weird teeth shop.
Yeah. And you just imagine, like, tiny baby Karoo sitting in the corner playing with his little tufty tail. And he just lets her do it. You know, he's a crotchety old grandpa, but he's just like, oh, whatever. She's pleased. And you know he's twitching his tail for her to catch and play with. You know he is.
Oh, completely. 100%. Yeah. And she's the only one who can do it.
Nobody else better fucking touch his tail at all.
No. Oh, we would acknowledge the fact that she's touching his tail.
Yeah.
Unsaid. Yeah.
Crushing
your granddad, but, you know, under the thumb of the grandchild.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Wrapped around her pinky, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like their dynamic. It's a cute coupling.
Yeah. Except, you know what surprised me about Brimstone?
What?
When he got so angry with Karoo when she went through the door. Because I feel like he should have known. You know, he knows a lot about her and obviously about her past life. And I feel like he should have seen signs of her, like, wanting to know more about that. And probably would know that she would go through that door at the very first chance she got. And then, instead of being so angry with her and throwing her out into the street, he probably should have told her what was going on. Because if he had, then she would have remembered to say, oh shit, the Seraphim are coming and you need to be ready. And then he probably wouldn't have died.
Yeah.
Which, you know, kind of all that has to happen to progress the story, but still, his anger seemed really irrational to me. And I'm sure that it was built mainly on fear, because, holy shit, you know, Thiago saw her, and he's gonna put two and two together, at least that something is going on. You know, I've built an entire human when I normally build animal people. So something's gotta be weird about this girl.
Yeah. It's mixed, isn't it? Because on one hand, you understand that Brimstone wants to keep what's behind the door secret from her,
mm-hmm.
to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to acknowledge that he's built a human. And humans are curious creatures.
Yeah.
And I can imagine even if she was Chimera, she would still be curious. You tell someone you can't go behind that door.
That's immediately what you're only going to want to do for the rest of your life.
Exactly. And then given any opportunity, you are going to take it. And the shop being empty, that door being open, it's kind of like, come through.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, she's not just going to shrug and walk away from an open door like that.
No. Mm-hmm.
She might spit in a unicorn's mouth first, but she's not going to shrug and walk away.
Poor unicorns always get the hard deal.
I know.
That's why they've got a long face. Ba-dum-tsh.
It is.
The other thing for me as well is, it's always down to communication, isn't it, in these books?
It is.
They don't communicate, and that's the problem. If he had told her what was going on and said, right, behind that door, it's another world. And in this world, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go through there, Thiago is going to want to lick sugar off you. Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
Is that going to make her any more or less curious?
I think that if he were to tell her about it and she, like, immediately wants to go there, I think he probably would have taken her, or it would have been an opportunity for him to take her himself.
Yes.
And so we wouldn't have had the issues that we have. Because, you know, even if, you know, he's giving her a tour and Thiago walks up, you know, Brimstone has a sort of like a radiance. And so I think that he would probably tell Thiago to fuck off. And like, I'll come back to you later. I'm dealing with this right now. And then we can talk about it. And it would be different.
Well, that's it. Because, I mean, at least if she's there with Brimstone, she's under Brimstone's protection.
Yeah.
Or wish a disguise.
Yeah. Wish her a bird beak. Wish her a horse head.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I honestly think that regardless of knowing what was behind that door or not, she's going to go through that door. She's going to be curious. She's either going to have foundations of knowledge that she's going to want to explore, or she's going to just want to play it and find out.
Yeah. Oh, I just thought of something. I thought of something that's different.
Yes.
Again, from that first question you asked me, differences between then and now, I don't think I realized originally when Akiva came to Earth, and he doesn't want to go back, and it's after the Battle of Loramendi, I don't think I realized the first time I read it that the Battle of Loramendi is when he killed Brimstone and Issa and Yasri and Twiga. I don't think I realized that, and now he's like completely crushed because he's, you know, also been kind of putting things together, and he also really loves Madrigal, and Madrigal really loved Brimstone, and he's just murdered him.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that the first time, but he's like the whole time, like, after Loramendi, I don't want to go back. After Loramendi, I don't want to go back. And so I was thinking, like, I was kind of putting that, like, in a before time. You know, after he, like, went back, after he healed.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so why is he so focused on Loramendi now? But no, because it like literally just happened not too long ago and he murdered everyone and he doesn't want to go back.
Yeah, that's the thing with his storyline is it's a lot more linear and things kind of happen as and when they go, you know, you're not jumping around with the progression.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit with the Karoo Madrigal, you kind of got to figure out, it's not like it's grey, it's not unclear, but you've kind of got to remember what one person knows and what the other person knows.
Yeah.
A little bit. But then, you know, Lainey Taylor does do a very good job of putting them in chunks.
Yeah.
So this is Karoo, this is Madrigal, this is Karoo learning about Madrigal, this is the repercussions of it all. So she does compartmentalise, yeah, I said the word right, very well.
Yeah.
She does do that very, very well. This was her debut novel, wasn't it? Was it her debut or her charity?
No, she'd had other stuff out before. I feel like this is probably her first popular one.
Yeah.
The first one that like really took off. But I don't think it was her first ever. I feel like even reading about it when I was doing my research, I feel like that she said that this was not her first one.
Dream Dark was her first novel.
Yeah.
It's like 2007.
Yeah.
And then Daughter of Smoke and Bones a few years later.
Yeah.
I think it's probably because it was the first time I ever became aware of Lainey Taylor. But that is an unsurprising thing that a lot of YA novel authors get snuck onto the UK shelves. Even the big ones.
Yeah. I haven't read that other series, though.
Oh.
So I'll probably need to go back and do that. Yeah. Well, I mean, this was the first. No, that's a lie. I read a book of short stories that she wrote first, called Lips Touch Three Times. And that was, she took the things from her notebooks and wrote stories about them. And then she wrote these. And these are the first ones that I read after that one came out.
Right. She must have boxes of notebooks.
Yeah. And she,
Is she a big pen? Does she have big penmanship?
I think so. And she, like, papier-mâché is the cover. with cool stuff to, like, go. Like, I feel like it's, like, one of Karu's sketchbooks. There's all sorts of stuff tucked in and stuff glued in and the cover's all fancy.
I always wish I could do a notebook that looked fancy and pretty and beautiful and, you know, something that somebody would pick up and go, ooh, not, yeah. What? What does this say?
Yeah.
Something about ham? Like, no, no. My handwriting's atrocious.
Yeah, I don't have good handwriting either. It looks like a serial killer.
If mine looked like a serial killer, nobody would know who I'd done, who I'd killed, how I'd killed them, or where I'd killed them. It's just illegible scroll. The amount of times I'll turn the book upside down and go, what?
What?
I'd have to really concentrate to have it in any way, shape, or form be legible. But, you know, that's by the by.
I think are you ready? I think it's time.
Yes. Are you ready for Would You Rather?
I am. I am ready. I think it's time.
So on social media, we asked you the very important question of, and I this is very important because I love this question. Would you rather wish your ex a temporarily itchy butt crack or the girl he cheated with ever-growing eyebrows?
Which vindictive petty wish do you choose?
I like to know people's vindictive petty wishes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Google search ever-growing eyebrows. It's a gallery of gloriousness. Do not Google itchy butt crack.
Mm-mm.
It's Mm-mm. not good.
Mm-mm. No, don't do that. It is not beautiful.
It's not, and I feel sick thinking about it. So let's find out what the social media said. On Facebook, 83%. You're giving some itchy butt cracks out here. Mm-hmm. That's a high
everybody percentage. Everybody's wishing for butt cracks.
Apart from 17%, they're getting ever-growing eyebrows. On Instagram, 67% again giving out itchy butt cracks, and 33% ever-growing eyebrows. And on Twitter, 71% itchy butt cracks, 29% ever-growing eyebrows. There are so many people in this world with itchy butt cracks, or some people with extremely itchy butt cracks, depending on who's giving the wishes. God damn it! Give them itchy butt cracks!
Yeah, so everyone has itchy butt cracks all over the place.
So many itchy butt cracks.
Yeah.
You need to get a lot of toilet paper and water in your hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you do.
We had loads of comments as well.
We did. We really did. And I really like that we've pretty much taken to reading almost every comment that we get now because we enjoy them so much, apart from the one-word responses.
Yeah.
You know.
Because that's not a why. That's usually a vote.
Yeah. Give us a full sentence and we'll read it. Pretty much almost always.
Yeah.
So we got some good ones this time. Tanya on Facebook said, in all capital letters, he deserved every itch. It's true.
It's true. And Coral on Facebook joins her with, itch away, jerk, itch away.
Melissa on Facebook said, why is it just itchy while nude modeling? I'd want that crack to be itchy all the most inopportune moments. All of them.
I'm getting a feeling so far that they have specific people in mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they've planned it out. They know who's going to have an itchy butt crack in their lives.
Exactly. Colin on Facebook says, itchy butt crack time, because then they'd have to scratch it and their hand would smell like butt. Ha! Butt hand.
Gross.
Gross.
Constance on Facebook says, oh, bless her. Bless her with the puns. She said, I love the idea of ever-growing eyebrows, but I'd blame the guy more than the girl. Enjoy the itchiness, my dude. Karma is a bitch.
Brie Tart on Instagram says, punish the ex, nude itching, with 3 burn symbols. Oh, no woman deserves ever-growing eyebrows.
Steph Inc. Creations on Instagram said, def the itchy butt. He is a bad guy, not the other girl. Plus, with trends these days, she would probably become more popular or something. And that's probably true because Fetla is very beautiful.
Yeah.
even like I see a, with her do the Google eyebrows. Search.
It's just not fair.
Yeah.
Our Jill on Instagram says, I vote for the eyebrows. In another comment, I definitely meant book crack, but can't read or type, and I can't delete my comment.
Oh, AJ Rulo, you're so great. You're so great. I love it. Danae Tesh on Instagram said, definitely the X, because with my luck, the girl would only set a new trend with the eyebrows, but the X will be a short but incredible feeling of vengeance. Although, can we spread lies about them as well? Because that would be so satisfying. And yes, I'm thinking along the lines of the movie 10 Things I Hate About You. Anytime you can throw that movie in, on it.
Yes. Also, I love the I love the phrase incredible feeling of vengeance.
Yes.
That's quotable.
Yeah, it's really good.
And lastly, at Lord Sock. Ho ho ho! Itchy butt crack. Ever growing eyebrows can be more easily dealt with, but your bun valley itching while modelling is just chef's kiss. The apex of revenge.
I responded to at Lord Sock on Twitter as myself in this comment because bun valley is my new favorite thing.
I love you need to have an incredible feeling of vengeance in your bun valley.
I do not want to have an incredible feeling of vengeance in my bun valley, but I love bun valley so much.
I've never heard it referred
to. I haven't either valley. And I love it more than anything.
It's genius.
Yeah,
it's genius.
It's my new favorite thing. Thanks.
This is why we love these comments, because we learn new things.
We do. We learn Bun Valley, and it's delightful.
We learn Bun Valley, and we learn that a lot of people have specific targets in mind.
Yes, clearly they do.
What about you? Are you giving an itchy butt crack or ever-growing eyebrows?
I mean, you know how I feel about eyebrows and the fact that I don't have any, and I feel like...
But... If it's just take away the eyebrow area, it's an area of ever-growing hair.
Yeah. Yeah, and every time she gets it waxed or tweezed or whatever, it just keeps coming back. And I feel like I would almost want to wish that on someone because of the amount of maintenance I have to do with my eyebrows and drawing them on every day. Like, I want someone else to have that. I want someone else to experience that pain. Even though mine's not painful because I just draw them on, it takes up time drawing my eyebrows on every day. So I want someone else to have eyebrow dealings.
Eyebrows get really itchy as well when they start growing back. Like, sometimes I just want to scratch away at mine. So it's kind of like you're getting a twofer. You're getting the ever-grown eyebrows, but you're also getting the constant itching.
Yeah. So what are you going to pick?
Can I just clarify, is this going to be on the X... Or are you going to... Because, you know, we are the masters of our own destiny and we can change the scenario how we like.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Are you giving the ever-growing eyebrows to the ex or the girl they cheated with?
Oh, definitely the girl he cheated with. I mean, he could have itchy eyebrows. He could have ever-growing eyebrows, too. Everybody. Just wish it on everyone. Except for myself. I could just wish them growing in one time.
In perfect shape.
Yeah. Exactly the way I draw them. That'd be really good. As I mourn my lack of eyebrows.
I know somebody who didn't have eyebrows and they got them tattooed on. And they look really good. But that means you are stuck with that one single set of eyebrows for the rest of your life. And they are. They're spectacular. She's had to have them done over a 2-year period though to get them all in. Spectacular. Yeah. But I really, you know, and we tattoos, I don't have any. And if you want to have some, fine. They're yours. Your body. Your body is the temple and you do them. But I never feel I commit to that particular thing.
And I don't think I'd want to. She's
committed to these eyebrows and completely.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want a face tattoo for sure.
Yeah.
That seems risky.
Plus, as a cosplayer, it's really handy for you to be able to actually manipulate your eyebrows.
It really is. It's really handy to not draw them on and then draw them on however I choose to.
Exactly.
Or put them on as rhinestones.
Exactly. You don't have to, like, disguise the hair at all. I mean, the amount of drag queens that actually get rid of their eyebrows to make it easier to then put the makeup on. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. Anywho, back in the room, I am going to go with the ever, well, it's not ever itching. I would like it to be. I'm going to go with the itchy butt crack because it's painful and annoying and embarrassing, especially if the nude modelling.
Yeah.
Because my issue is with the girl, does she know she is the quote unquote the woman?
She probably does, at least in this Kaz and Svetla sort of way, because Kaz told them all about their first time, and then she, like, kind of mocks her about it, wearing a cape and only a cape, and talking about how capes are making a comeback, and it's just kind of, it's kind of gross.
It's gross and tacky.
Yeah, you'd have to know.
She'd only know, though, because of him.
Yeah. But that still, the fact that she chooses to make that comment, to do that, it makes her pretty crappy.
Totally. I would give him the other, I would give him the itchy butt crack, but then I would have to think of something for her.
Yeah.
Quite honestly.
Well, I mean, that's why Karu does both of the wishes.
Well, exactly. And I'm all for it. You know, I don't mind a bit of additional vengeance. I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But if I can only pick one, I'm going to pick the itchy butt crack on the ex.
Yeah.
He slighted her too many ways.
Yeah, he did. All right, next question. Would you rather watch Susanna's puppet show or go on Kaz's vampire tour? Not being a part of it, going on the tour.
It's going to have to be Kaz's vampire tour for me. I love that kind of thing. It's right up my street.
Yeah.
So it's going to have to be the vampire tour. Even if I can't be part of it, I can still enjoy it as a patron.
Yeah.
What about you?
As much as I love puppets, marionettes kind of freak me out. Yeah. So I think I'd go on the vampire tour. Or a ghost tour. I would go on the tour.
Yeah.
Just because marionettes creep me out. And even though she's life-size and it's her and she's, you know, being a beautiful tiny dancer, I don't know.
She's still almost the size of a marionette puppet, to be
fair. She is. She's tiny.
She's so dinky.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and as much as I love puppets, marionettes creep me out. So yeah, I'm going on the tour as well.
Yeah. I think you could safely watch, like, a Cirque du Soleil show and get the kind of feel from Susanna's puppet show.
Yeah.
But from a safe, less marionette infused distance.
I mean, to be fair, I would go and watch her puppet show, but I would rather go on a vampire tour.
Yeah.
And as you know, the name of this game is Would You Rather. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
However, not part of the game, if you did go to Prague, you would do the puppet show one night and then you do the vampire tour the next
for
night.
For sure. Or, I mean, she was doing the marionette theater all day long, so I could catch her during the day and then go on the vampire tour at night.
Exactly. So best of both worlds. And remember, masters of our own destiny. Would you rather?
It's true. We are.
So next question: would you rather be made of tears or darkness?
Oh, darkness, 100%. I already am.
I'm with you there.
Made of darkness.
I'm with you there. Tears seems a bit sad.
Yeah.
Darkness seems interesting.
Yeah. Would you rather be friends with Razgut or Thiago? And they're friendly to you. You would be friendly with them. You know, you're not just going to be like a sycophant running around after Thiago, but...
Is Razgut stuck on my shoulders? Do I have to carry him around like some kind of horrible backpack?
Like a Yoda backpack?
Yeah, no. Except less Yoda-ish.
Can you do flips? Can you do flips through the swamp while wearing
it? I would like that to happen. If that could happen, yeah, definitely. Do you know what? Thiago's an absolute fucking dick. So it's going to have to be Razgut, because at least, like, I feel like with Razgut, you might be able to have a good time. With Thiago, it would get very creepy and a little bit too familiar in a non-consensual way.
Yeah. But I feel like if you're friends with Thiago. I mean, I feel like he's got a lot of sway. He's got a lot of pull. So if you are that kind of person to take advantage of friendships like that, you could probably get pretty much anything you want if you were friends with Thiago.
Probably. I got, like, do you remember when we read One of Us is Lying? Jake.
Mm-hmm.
I got major, like, Jake vibes from Thiago. Like, he's the leader of the pack. He's the leader of his mean crowd. And just because you're friends with him doesn't make you a nice person.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to break away from that to be able to, you know, identify, like, find your own identity. Because you'd be too lost in his shadow.
Yeah.
He is his own centre of the universe. And if he's not your centre of the universe, he is not interested in you. And frankly, I do not like that, and I'm not interested in that. I think at least with Razgut, you can go on a, you know, go on a bender with him, or, you know, it'd be just funny on a night out, or you could just sit there and people watch, and he'd be like, that person this, that person that. I just, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, he was wished onto Aziel's shoulders to tell him, you know, everything. So he probably knows a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Could be good. I think I'd be friends with Razgut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he wants to go home, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Take me home, brother.
You kind of got to imagine, is it established in the book at all that, you know, why it was Razgut put on his shoulders?
Well, because the Bruxis, you know, when you make that value of wish, it ain't going to turn out good.
No, it's like making a wish with a djinn, isn't it?
Yeah, it just makes me think of the Wishmaster movies. I love those movies so much because they're so bad, but that's just what I think of with making a Bruxis wish. Yeah. And, you know, how much pain, we don't know this at the time, but how much pain does it take to grant that wish? So you gotta be kind of terrible when you're gifting that wish to someone.
Yeah,
you got to get something out of it.
I think, but it's the other half of, like, well, he's made the wish to have all this knowledge. There you go. There's the knowledge. It's in the form of an angel called Razgut. What's Razgut's part of this deal? Like, did he have to make some kind of deal as well?
I feel like it's just punishment.
He is being punished for something of unknown.
Yeah, because, I mean, he's a seraphim. And so, of course, Brimstone's not going to like him because he's an angel. So you can punish two birds with one stone, I guess.
So is Razgut a random punishment or just somebody had, like, lying around?
I mean, he probably
just
had...
There's your seraphim backpack.
He probably had him, you know, like, stored somewhere. And he's finally like, I gotta fucking get rid of this angel.
You know, when you do stock take and you just find that random thing that's been there for years and you're like, I will sell this eventually.
Yeah.
And it's just a Razgut in a box going, take me home, let me go home.
Yep. And he's like, well, I'm not going to take you home, but I will get you the fuck out of my office. And so then you take him and you just, here you go. This guy knows a lot. And now he's going to give you a hunchback. Here you go.
And he has one of those, like, you know, those yellow or orange Illuminous star stickers on. That's, like, on sale.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super discounted.
Yeah. And it's, like, three or four over the top where, you know, it might have cost you three wishes, but now it just costs two. Now it's one. Now it's, you know, I'll give you a wish if you take him off my hands.
Yes. Yeah. Get this guy
out
of here.
What you doing, Brimstone?
Oh,
make me a sandwich. I'm just a wizened old seraphim backpack. Yeah. Stop putting your keys in me.
Yep. Don't put your keys into Razgut. That's not a good idea. I can't imagine, like, what he looks like, because, you know, all the seraphim are beautiful. So I imagine he's got this beautiful face, and, like, they mention that he has, like, beautiful teeth. But then, you know, like, he's twisted and scarred, and his wings were ripped off his back, and, like, his legs are broken in a million ways, so he can't get around, and he's just, like, this shriveled little thing with a beautiful face.
Yeah. You know when you see, like... You know when you see like I want to say American TV shows because it tends to be one of those, or movies, and it's quite clearly not their real teeth.
Oh, he's got big. He's got big fake veneers.
Yeah,
like, he's got big chompers. Yeah.
Uh huh. Bright white, yeah. And you're just like, nah, nah. And they've got greased back hair. And you just think, are you a second-hand car salesman or a lawyer?
Both, or a fallen angel.
Or a fallen angel. Now we're just going to declare all of these guys seraphim. So, yes. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
That was delightful.
It's good. Good one. We still have another question left, don't we?
I think we do.
What is it?
It is, after I take my sip of tea, would you rather be a chimera or an angel?
It's a tough one.
And I'm also going to say, if you're a chimera, you can pick if you are half human or if you have a bestial aspect. And what parts are you made up of? And what parts
you have, yeah.
Sub questions. Will you be beautiful? Will you have a mukau face?
This is a really tough question for me to answer.
I think it's just a tough question completely. I'd be interested to post this one, actually, in the Would You Rather group on Facebook as a little bit of a...
Well, we will probably talk about it when we have our book club meeting, because you know we're going to talk about this book too.
Yes, when is the book club meeting, Amanda?
Monday, December 28th at 3 p.m. Pacific.
11 p.m. GMT. All times in between and around, depending on your time zone.
Yes. So maybe we can ask it to the wide world of Would You Rather after the book club meeting.
Definitely.
I really like the idea of being an angel because I like their, like, fiery burning wings. But really in this situation, the angels are definitely the bad guys. And do I want to be that bad guy who is the bad guy because you've treated all of the people beneath you like shit? Or do you want to just be the bad guy because you're a bad guy? I think I would prefer that. Maybe I could be a stellion, which they're not mentioned very much in this one, but they are seraphim that are not involved. That's like really all you know about them, is mm-hmm. that they're not involved with any of this shit going on. And also they have magic.
Which is nice.
So maybe I'll be a stellion. But also I really like the idea of being a creature. But I would be high human aspect if I was a chimera. I can't decide. I want to be both.
No.
I want to have wings. Okay. Regardless. I want to have wings. I think I want to be an angel for the fiery burning wings.
Are you locking that answer in?
For now.
So no. I instantly, unequivocally, chimera.
What kind?
I want wings, like you say. Mm-hmm. I don't want feathered wings. Because you know how I feel about birds.
Mm-hmm. You don't want insect wings, because you know how you feel about insects. So you want bat wings?
I wouldn't mind bat wings. I don't mind the idea of dragonfly wings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's only certain insects that bother me, like
bees. You don't want moth wings.
I just don't like moths. Everything else, I'm not aware of. I don't like spiders, because spiders are creepy. They've got far too many legs and eyes. That's just mm-hmm. not right.
Yeah.
And I don't like moths because of the childhood trauma incident.
Right.
I quite like dragonfly wings. I think they're pretty cool. But I think probably bat wings. I'd probably go high human as well, but I would like something interesting around the ear area. Do you remember Stardust when she had, when his mum, Lady Ina, had cat ears with little tuft things? Something along those lines where it's kind of a subtle fancy ear thing going on.
Okay.
Horns? Yes, I will accept horns as well. I don't know what kind. Not a mono horn. I'm not going down the unicorn route. Okay. It would have to be two horns. It would be nice to be... I always quite like the imagery of Karoo's gazelle.
Mm-hmm.
Quite svelte and agile and athletic, because that's the exact opposite to me.
Would you have a tail?
Oh, now you see, that's a very good question. because you're already kind of cumbersome with wings. You're adding in an extra thing if you've got a tail as well.
Yeah, but you would know how to use it.
That is very true. That is very true. I don't think I would have a tail. I think I would go tailless. But I don't know what else I would be like body-wise. Because, okay, I've got the human face and probably like the human chest area. But down hip below might be a bit different. I don't know if I would want hoofs.
Now, last week you wanted to be a mountain goat.
Yeah, but that was like full-on goat and just stand there in impossible places going, bah.
Yeah. What about your hands? Would you have arms? Would you have claws?
Ooh. Possibly a bit of a mix. So, predominantly hands, but kind of like tapered into a claw.
Oh, like Thiago's hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got most of the pattern down, I think. Are you still locked in with Angel?
You know what? No, I'm not, because the Chimera have the Hamsas. And the Hamsas are really cool. And also they can use weapons. So that would also be another cool thing. I mean, most of them can, because most of them are soldiers. So that would also be a cool thing. To have Hamsas.
Is difficult.
Yeah, it really is.
I've never seen you really struggle with the would you rather quite so much. I mean, we've had gross ones where it's like, what's the least gross?
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, this is quite a nice one actually.
It really is, and they're both very appealing. Still think I'm gonna go Angel though. I like the idea of fiery wings. Like if I could have phoenix wings and they were also on fire. Okay, then.
You could have mythological creatures within the Chimera, because that's, in theory, what they are. So you could have Phoenix in your Chimera aspect.
Yeah. Still think I'm going to go with Angel. Fiery wings and magic are pretty good.
The bonus to being a Chimera as well, if you're slain, like Brimstone,
can you put you
in a different body, and you'd be like, you could pre-order.
Yeah, like, next time I want to have this instead.
Yeah, let's give a tail a go.
You'd have to be really nice to Brimstone, though, because if you weren't nice to Brimstone, and then you were killed and you had to come back, you might come back as an eel.
Oh, I love that. That was class.
I loved it, too. I love everything about Brimstone. He's just the perfect crotchety grandpa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bet he gives great hugs.
I bet he does.
But not in front of anybody.
No, no. No. Okay, that's the end of Would You Rather. That was a tough one.
That was.
That was a tough one. So now, favorite final thought quote. You got any good ones?
I've got two.
Okay.
I've got a one for fun and a one that stood out to me.
Okay.
So my one for fun is, it's not like there's a law against flying. Yes, there is. The law of gravity.
Ah, oh, Zeus. Very good. Very good.
And my the one that stood out for me, my bit more serious, is the what kind of friendship was based on evasions and lies? It's not a friendship.
No, you gotta tell the truth. You gotta have a true story. Even if it's completely unbelievable. Gotta tell the truth. Mine.
Yes.
I also have two. One for fun. Too bad he's such a gargantuan asshole. A giant stupid orifice. A walking, talking cranny.
I have a feeling you've used this in real life.
Well, now I just want to add something about a bun valley to the end of it.
Bun valley sounds soft, doesn't it?
Yeah,
come to
it does.
My bun valley and it's like squidgy. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. An itchy bun valley. A smelly, itchy bun valley.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah. Smelly, itchy bun valley. Gosh. Add that to the end. Add that to the end of that quote.
I can smell it. It's awful.
It's bad. It's bad.
We've done some very visceral books lately.
We have.
Do you have a more serious one?
I do have a more serious one. Okay. Hope? Hope can be a powerful force. Maybe there's no actual magic in it, but when you know what you hope for most and hold it like a light within you, you can make things happen. Almost like magic.
Oh, I like that.
I like it too.
That's hope your magic and whimsy all wrapped
yeah,
up.
Yeah, it
in
is.
One nice quote.
Hope is very important in this series, so I felt it important to have a quote about hope.
Well, that's also what Crew means.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and that's why her name means that, because
exactly.
That's all Brim's. He was putting all of his hopes into her to end the war.
Oh, Grandad Rimstorm. I feel like we need to have a moment for him.
Okay.
That was lovely.
Yeah. So, if you liked this, try this. What do you recommend this time?
It's one I've seen quite a few of the book groups, book clubs, whatever, talking about, and always in favourable terms. And when I looked at it, I thought, oh, actually I quite fancy it myself. So I've not read it, but it is one that is on my radar. Shatter Me by Tahara Mafi, and it's described as X-Men meets The Handmaid's Tale in the first installment. So it's a fragile young teenage girl is held captive, locked in a cell by the Re-Establishment, a harsh dictatorship in charge of a crumbling world. This is no ordinary teenager. Juliet is a threat to the Re-Establishment's power. A touch from her can kill. One touch is all it takes. But not only is she a threat, she is potentially the most powerful weapon they could have. Juliet has never fought for herself before, but when she's reunited with the one person who ever cared about her, the depth of the emotion and the power within her become explosive. And that is from waterstones.com. I thought it sounded interesting. I like the whole finding yourself, being reunited with somebody, having power you didn't know you had and potential that you didn't know you had. It kind of felt like it was similar themes. And what about you, Madel? What do you have?
Well, I want everyone to go and read the rest of this series, because I don't know if we'll get to it on the podcast or not, because we've got so many things coming up. But something that I feel like often goes unread within the series is the tiny story that comes later. It was published later, but it kind of happens during the same time as this one. It's called Night of Cake and Puppets, and it is also, of course, by Lainey Taylor, and from Goodreads. In this standalone companion to the New York Times bestselling Daughter of Smoke and Bone series comes the story of Mick and Susanna's fantastical first date.
It's
illustrated by Jem DiBartolo, who is Lainey Taylor's husband.
Ah.
And there are some very cute doodles of Susanna throughout, and I love it. So, the summary says, petite though she may be, Susanna is not known for timidity. Her best friend Carew calls her rabid fairy. Her voodoo eyes are said to freeze blood, and even her older brother fears her wrath. But when it comes to the simple matter of talking to Mick, or Violin Boy, her courage deserts her. Now, enough is enough. Susanna is determined to make the first move. And she has a fistful of magic and a plan. It's a wonderfully elaborate treasure hunt of a plan that will take Mick all over Prague on a cold winter's night before leading him to the treasure. Herself! Violin Boy is not going to know what hit him. And it's such an adorable story, and it's more Susanna. And you get to know more about Susanna and Mick.
Aww.
And it's great.
I like short stories where it kind of reunites those little characters and rekindles it.
Now you get more Susanna and Mick throughout the rest of the series as well, but this is really cute.
It's concentrated. I like the concentrated nature of it, I should say.
Yeah. It's really good. Wonderful. And the illustrations are adorable. And also at the end of this one, or at least in the ebook version, there's illustrated the scene when they go to Poison Kitchen from Daughter of Smoke and Bone, like graphic novel style. So that's also really, it's cool and it's in there and it's fun.
So this isn't graphic novel, it's just an illustrated book.
Yes. Yeah, nice. There are drawings throughout the text.
Nice. I like those ones. It brings a little something extra to it, doesn't it? Definitely extra dimension. Nice. Mm-hmm. I like that. I like that a lot. Yep.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Okay, well, that's it for this episode of Fictional Hangover. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Claire.
Ooh!
Oh, no!
Join us next time as we go live on Facebook on Tuesday, December 22nd at noon Pacific, 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, and discuss the short story Dark Christmas by Jeanette Winterson, available for free at theguardian.com. If you miss us live, don't worry. We're still releasing the audio of the episode at our normal time on Wednesday, or you can watch the replay anytime on our Facebook page. Look out for our Would You Rather polls on social media. Don't forget about our book club and monthly challenges on Facebook. Be sure to visit our shop on Redbubble at fictionalhangove.redbubble.com for all your favorite Fictional Hangover-themed merchandise. And now become a patron of ours on Patreon at patreon.com/fictionalhangover or support us on Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/fictionalhangover. Until next time, remember, the only cure for a fictional hangover is another book. Why are we doing it again? Why are we doing it?
Because we liked it last time secretly and we're masochistic.
You can find us at fictionalhangover.com, follow us on Instagram at fictionalhangover, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fictionalhangover and on Twitter at fictionalhangover, no ER. If you'd like this episode, check out our others and rate, review and subscribe so you don't miss out. And finally, special thanks to Liz Emerson for our music. You can find her on Facebook and Patreon. Thanks for listening.